The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
Good afternoon. Thanks for being here. I hope you've had a great morning. Already had some excellent seminars. Went to one this morning. I learned how to really improve my sorority rush for next fall. I'm excited about that. Have me a pink shirt up in my room. Excited. I'm glad you're here. We're going to talk a little bit about school leadership today. My name is Keith Nix. I serve as the head of school at Veritas School in Richmond, Virginia, where I've been for 6 years. Prior to that, I was at the Westminster School in Birmingham, Alabama, for many years as a board member toward the beginning of the school, and then 6 years as the head of school there. And so my passion, even before I got into headship, in my prior life in business and in the nonprofit sector, was growing organizations. And so each time I became head, the school was around a couple of hundred students, and my job and my calling and my passion was to grow schools to maturity, to help to achieve things like tuition covering the cost of operating your school and waiting lists and grades and all those beautiful things. And we've had some success at both of those schools in those areas and many more. And I'm going to share a little bit about some of those things. David wanted to make sure I also said that I serve on the ACCS board. I'm also involved with the Society for Classical Learning and really enjoy being involved with and in relationship with the schools around the country that are at this hard job, doing this hard work. A friend of mine wrote about this tough job we have, and as heads of schools, even board members or administrators, this is good to read, because one of the challenges, all of you have seen it, if you've been at more than one school or considered it being at more than one school, you've seen the job profile from an opening at another classical Christian school come around. And it's the looking for Jesus with the PhD job description. We know there's not a human being that fits that job description, but we know that, and because of that, perhaps no one's more qualified than we are, so we might as well give it a shot. And so I could read one of those job profiles, but a friend of mine wrote a little narrative, and it goes something like this as he sought to explain his job, his duties, if you will. I'm to maintain an intimate walk with Christ and embody the ideals of the school, to be a servant leader whose conduct exemplifies biblical principles and whose life exhibits balance between personal duties and home life. Be the resident expert in a philosophy of education I was not trained in myself. Hire, evaluate, and grow teachers in that same philosophy. Ensure the safety of everyone in the school. Lead the charge in raising millions of dollars, which I've never done before. Manage a multi-million-dollar budget. Understand the dynamics and complexities of board governance. Collaborate with the board to develop a strategic plan. Create policies for teachers and students that are fair, legal, and wise. Develop a curriculum that is clearly articulated, aligned, and Christ-centered. Manage the myriad of conflicts among constituents in and outside of school. Be visible throughout the school day. Have a good rapport with students of all ages. Be personable and attentive to families. Be assertive and decisive at just the right moments. Articulate the vision through public and written addresses. Establish school improvement initiatives and steward them over long periods of time. Assign roles to each employee to help them and the school thrive. All that in addition to scheduling, accreditation, professional development, massive building project, complex spiritual dynamics among students, growing the school, dealing with crisis, modeling everything we say the student should be. And since this is so much fun already, let's consider some other factors that make our calling even more daunting and unachievable. Not just me, but the entire school community is on a spectrum of understanding the nuances of this philosophy, including parents, board members, including parents and board members, which makes communication, collaboration, conflict resolution, and consensus virtually impossible. We also live in a culture that is unashamedly utilitarian. Thus, Latin, philosophy, the great books, and virtually our whole curriculum are largely rejected or questioned from the outset. We live in a Christian culture that is continually teetering between fundamentalism and liberalism, which in most cases makes classical and Christian seem like a contradiction in terms. And oh yeah, I'm to love the Lord my God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength, to serve my church family, to love my wife as Christ loved the church, raise my children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord, love my neighbors, myself, to cap it all off. Besides shepherding students, we all have the proclivity to be sinful, lazy, and foolish. We are desperately trying to resist our natural tendency of being in love with ourselves while we manage our own households and just try to read the Bible every day. So it's crazy that people want this job, right? It's a tough job, but it's a rewarding one. And I've had the privilege of doing it for 12 years. And not only have I worked at local schools, but I've spent a good bit of my time over the last 6 or 7 years with lots of other schools, lots of other boards and heads. So I'm going to talk about some essentials. That's a tough thing to say because it's a bit subjective. And I'm okay with it being subjective because I would say these are things that I have found essential. Good things to talk about. Your list may not be exactly the same. But if you run down a list, if you broke down that list that I just read earlier and just list all the areas of operation of a school, ISM's list has like 16 things, 16 areas, which is probably about right. It tends to cover everything. I really have come to the opinion that for a head of school, there are four things on that list, and then I'm going to sneak in a fifth and a sixth. So it says four in there. But the fifth I intended to sneak in, but I've added a sixth in recent months. Four things that only the head can do, and you have to learn to be able to do well. So I'm going to start with that list. I will say another thing, especially following the last talk. Is Bill still in here? He's gone. So I'm like many of you in the early days of classical Christian education. I didn't trust the painter to come paint my schoolrooms who didn't understand classical Christian education. Like, you just won't get it. I'm trying to buy furniture now, and I'm going to one of these companies that's selling furniture for the 21st century classroom, and it's just such a mess. And so we had this natural suspicion for people who don't really get us. Over the years, I've softened a bit, and I've learned there's a thing called common grace, and there really are some good independent school best practices. I'm probably the biggest implementer of some of ISM's tools and practices in the room. At the same time, I have to have my filter on all the time, especially as more and more conversation gets into what is defined by this nebulous 21st century learning term and what they mean by the child-centered classroom, because our antennas go up because we think, well, children want McDonald's and we know something's better, or they want pop music and we want to show them something different. So there are things that have to be worked through. So I'm a fan of ISM and I use their tools. I'm going to present a lot of those, but I also think I've got to be thoroughly looking at everything. Really circumspectly. So anyway, but there is common grace out there. Professionalism isn't a bad word. When I came to my school in Richmond and wanted to bring professionalism, a lot of the families thought that meant at the expense of relationships and community, and I don't believe that's true. It just meant doing a better job at a lot of things we ought to be doing. And so that's what I've been working at for the last few years. So four non-negotiables that I think a head of school must be able to do. Now, because of time, this really is about four or five talks I do with heads of boards over a couple of days. So some things I'm going to go over very quickly. I'm happy to provide the PowerPoint and wish I could go deeper. But the first non-negotiable is vision. A couple of speakers earlier said this. The head of school has to be the one telling the story of the school. They have to be the one who articulates the message of classical education. So we'll talk about that. The second one is strategy. I am big on a well-done strategic plan that's followed. A lot of schools and a lot of your experience with this process of writing a plan that just goes on a shelf and is not usable, that's not an excuse for not doing strategy well. So we'll talk about that. And what I mean by that is directing the strategy. So I think the head of school has to be the one who can, in a compelling way, tell the school story. Strategy, the head of school has to be the person who's worked after a strategic plan is written in conjunction with the board and stakeholders. The head of school has to be one that visibly owns that strategy and is directing energies and focus toward accomplishing it. The third one is people, and especially I mean the immediate people around you, your leadership team, what ISM would call your B ring, that next concentric circle of direct reports. There are also key people that only you can relate to that fall into other categories, certain key parents, certain key donors that you have to interact with. But I'm especially, when I say people there, I'm especially talking about the leadership team level of the school underneath the head. The fourth one is culture. The head of school is the chief culture maker. I like to say, people ask me what I do. I'm the chief cultural architect of the school. It's the most important of the four, I believe. And then there's a fifth that it's on there because no one else is allowed to do this. You have to relate to the board well and lead up, as Bill talked about earlier. And I hope to get into some of the tips I would give you for leading up and relating to your board and creating a healthy board dynamic. I have an unbelievable board in Richmond, Virginia. I had a strong board in Birmingham, but we worked at it really hard. I work at it really hard. It makes everyone's life easier. So these are the areas that we'll try to cover today and try to draw out some principles and practices in these areas and really close it out at the end with some things that I would maybe I'll draw out a few throughout the talk and really leave you with four or five to challenge you with to go and really make some progress in, because I think there's some items that I'll talk about today that I think are difference makers. First of all, vision. You're the face. The head of the school is the face of the school, and heads of schools have varying different personalities. I am at Veritas School in Richmond, Virginia, and I think one of our founding or earliest heads, Scott Taylor, is in the room. If you know Scott and I, where's Scott? He was here. There he is. Scott and I aren't very much alike, personality-wise. But I know families in my school today that are there because Scott had this ability to bring people into his office and tell the story of classical Christian education in a way that they heard it, they believed it, and they bought in. Now, I think we know how much culture is moving and shifting, and we've got to find words that work. You've got to find words that work. I say you've got to find words that work with the dad at the ballpark. Chris Perrin is one of my dear friends. He's not great at talking to the dad at the ballpark. He's great at coming in and talking to faculty and inspiring faculty and staff. But we need those words without dumbing it down, but it needs to be colloquial. We need to get to a point where we can cast that vision, tell the story. And one of the things that I've done over the recent years, especially as I've started getting into capital campaigns, and I'm responsible now not just for casting the vision to new parents, that's my most common vision casting exercise. I've been working over the last few years of us at our school, me and our team, casting the vision to our students, which is important, educating the students on their education. Once a year I have an assembly and I go, okay, I need to remind you what I promised your parents I was doing to you. You need to know. So I've got to learn to say it to them in a way that makes them want it. But I've been learning to do it with donors, which is a different proposition. It's got to be even quicker, more succinct, more accessible. And I have a coach, actually, that helps me in consulting. And he makes me practice in front of him. It's the most uncomfortable thing. I'm so nervous. But I'll call him before I go to a big donor meeting, and he'll say, what are you going to say? And I'll rehearse it. And I'm getting better and better at messaging of telling that classical Christian message to different audiences. And I think as a head of school, that needs to be a priority for you to find those words that work for you, the settings that work for you, because for some of you, it might be up front at a big parent rally and you've got people eating out of your hands. Others might be the quiet meeting in the office. There are lots of difference, or on the playground, just shoulder to shoulder. But I don't think the head of school can give that job away. So that's number one. Number two is strategy. I'm a big fan of writing a strategic plan. And what I propose is three or four of the most important things that you can do to discipline your board, that your board can do to discipline itself together. You're on the board. Discipline the board and the head's activities for a given year. And so I think that I'm going to do this real simply and quickly. I've become a fan of four-year strategic plans. I think five is too long. ISM used to say six. I think that's way too long. So much changes from my experience. But whatever number you pick. So you write a strategic plan. I don't have time to go into the process that I would share or recommend, but you write a strategic plan. There are lots of ways to do that. And then at the end of year one, you update that plan. You look at that plan and say, does it need any tweaking or updating? And then from that plan, when you write it originally and each year that you update it, you do two things. And you can find resources on each of these things if you search it on the ISM website. But one is called the Head of School Annual Agenda. So what you do with the board, and especially the Head Support and Evaluation Committee, how many of you have heard of a Head Support and Evaluation Committee? Okay, I'll share a little bit more about that. But I think it's that and the Committee on the Trustees are the two committees on the board that are crucial. And like Bill said earlier, you might need to do putting some articles in front of the right people saying, hey, we ought to consider this committee. It ensures the adequate support and accountability for a head. One of the things that happens in this process is we write a strategic plan, and that strategic plan has a number of things on it, and we look at that plan annually, and we say, okay, some of these strategic objectives are more board-related activities, right? But some of them are clearly we're giving to the head of school to execute with his team. So at the end of the school year, we're in the process of this now, finalize it for the next year. I write, together with my head support and evaluation committee, an agreed upon one-pager annual agenda. So I'm writing right now my annual agenda for 16 and 17. And so there's three or four strategic objectives for the year that are on my agenda, and usually for me, six to eight operational things. So an operational one might be, Keith is responsible for hitting the annual fund goal of $200,000, and I'm accountable to that. It's something that they want me to answer to all throughout the year, but at the end of the year. On the strategic side, it might be something like, lead the capital campaign and raise X numbers of dollars. It might be oversee the implementation of a professional development program, or get accredited, or, you know, it could be a number of things. But what that does is that keeps you from having that Superman list and the board at the end of the year just willy-nilly going, well, how do you think you did? That's great. I didn't like that. You can't be responsible for that the list that's in a job profile. So you take that job profile, you take the strategic plan, and you come up with a one-pager. I meet with my head support and evaluation committee four times a year, and I report against that one-pager. At the end of the year, I'm never surprised by my evaluation because I've reported against it three times during the year. Some head support and evaluation committees meet monthly, and I think that's fine. When I was new at Veritas, we met monthly. What that does is creates great security for me and empowers me to go execute against this defined list of things instead of you're head of school, do everything, and do everything well. And that's an impossible situation. The strategic plan is crucial in coming up with that annual agenda. Secondly, our board comes up with an annual agenda for the board, and they do the same thing. They usually pick two to three things that they're going to do and accomplish in the year. They decide if it currently fits an active committee or whether an ad hoc committee needs to form, and they assign that to board members, and it's similar that during the year we're tracking that. So the board and the head activities are aligned based on the strategic plan, agreed upon, and accountable to. and it creates great security. The other part of the Head Support and Evaluation Committee, it really is about support. It always has an element of how are you doing, what do you need, what resources do you need to be able to execute the things that are on that sheet of paper, on that annual agenda. And so there are a number of things, again, that I don't have time to talk about, but I would encourage, this would be one of those big takeaways. Learn what a Head Support and Evaluation Committee is. Learn how to put one together and implement it. It's one of my top five things that I would recommend learning to do and doing well. I went over the cycle, talked about discipline. The other thing, the other really important part about the strategic plan is most strategic plans do a good job of capturing the big ideas. You know, let's get accredited. Most strategic plans that say something like get accredited don't have a good number, financial number, of what it will cost to actually do that, and it's not built into the budget. And so the strategic plan lots of times sounds good, and you get to these things and say, oh, that was a great idea. We can't afford it. And a lot of times the strategic objectives are set 3 and 4 years out, but we don't do a good enough job forecasting and having a real disciplined budget, not just for the next year, but years out, that we're not really ready to accomplish those things. And I'll make a brief comment on that at the end. So I think that as the head of school, you've got to work closely with the board to make sure that you have a strategic plan. And then once that is accomplished around that plan, you execute a plan to get that done, part of which is the board, part of which is you. And then you organize. You're the person who goes to your faculty and staff and says, this is where we're going together, and it takes all of us. And then it becomes, there's a working document side of the strategic plan that looks a little bit like an Excel sheet with drop-down menus and priorities and how much they cost. And then you give it to your people in marketing or communications or just somebody who's talented and say, go make this really cool to our constituents. You know, write this up, put it in a brochure in a way that when your parents read it, they have the reaction that Bill was talking about earlier. You know, this is awesome. This is where our school is going. This is great for children. This is great for our city. This is great for our world. Let's rally around this. Then, when the costs that are associated with it do get built into tuition, or there's a capital campaign to get there, you've laid the groundwork. You've built the runway. You've greased the track, so to speak. So, head of school, the only one who can be the primary vision caster, certainly you want others to do it. You want others to participate, but the head can't not do it, is what I'm saying. You want to equip others to do it. But I will tell you this, most of us have tried really hard to help every one of our parents be able to tell another parent what classical Christian education is, and you probably not had a lot of success. I would go with the Jesus method of with the blind man who couldn't explain how Jesus did what he did, but he said, all I know is I was blind, but now I see. Get your parents just saying, here's what it's been like for my child. That's all parents need to do. Equip your parents to say, I don't understand classical Christian education completely. You might pick a thing or two that you do understand, but say, what I do know is this. So I'm not saying the head of school is the only one casting the vision, but he's the primary one, and he can't or she can't not do it. So vision, strategy, key people, your leadership team, developing that team, especially in a growing school. I'm going to go ahead and get through these so that I don't skip any. But so the idea is, as a school grows, obviously a school that's under 100, maybe 150, is still in that very flat stage, whereas there's a lead administrator and a bunch of faculty. But as that school grows, a head has got to be able to hire good people underneath them and develop them. If I read the list, other than this four I'm mentioning this morning, and if I read the other 12 and got into facilities and lots of other areas, different heads of schools are going to have different talents and abilities within that list of other things. But you're going to have certain things that you're just not good at. And the head's ability to surround themselves, to know themselves, and to build a team around them is crucial. No one else can do that. And the primary thing it takes is emotional intelligence. I would read the short little Harvard Business Review book on emotional intelligence. It just takes excerpts from some of the best books out there. But one of the things we're learning about it is that it's something that certainly there's a starting point for all of us. Some have great emotional intelligence, not so much, but it's not a fixed point. It can move, but paying attention to the emotional intelligence areas like self-regulation, self-awareness, social skills, empathy. More and more is coming out about just how crucial that is, and that goes into what Bill said earlier about teachers relating to parents. When I don't see that happening well, frequently I don't see the emotional intelligence that's there to have those conversations. So I would highly value, look for, assess, and have a plan to develop higher emotional intelligence and develop it in your team. I think one of the dangers we all also face in developing our key people is that even though we know we're not Superman, we try to be. Dan Allender, I think, came out with a book a couple of years ago, Leading with the Limp. I think this is an incredibly important aspect to our leadership. We have got to be able to show vulnerability and weakness to the people we lead. Andy Crouch has a new book, Strong and Weak, and he talks about how in a position of power we have to display both strength and weakness to be effective in leadership. I think this is huge in the life and role of the head because that frees up everybody underneath you to make mistakes, and they're going to do much better work and be much more creative if they're not trying to avoid making mistakes. And so I'm not good at this. This is the one on the thing that I would probably get ranked really low by all my faculty and staff, but we've at least said it. It's at least on the table. And when people say it to me again, it's kind of like, yeah, I know. But it's really important. Here's why it's really important, because I think it goes down into the classroom. I think one of the biggest things we can do to affect heart change and get the attention of our students is when we model repentance in front of them. And schools are a hard place to model repentance. The classroom is a really hard place for a teacher to say, I was wrong. And so I think that's got to come down from the top, this leading with a limp idea. And I think we have to say it because then we become accountable to it. So if this is being recorded, I'm kind of stuck now if somebody listens to this talk and I'm accountable to it. But I think it goes throughout the organization where you're openly admitting your weakness and need with your teammates. I think it's the only way we can get to the culture we want to get to in our schools, and especially with our children, and the only way we can achieve our objectives. The other aspect of this, one of the ways that I talk about it, and some of these points will come out in the between this one and culture will be kind of confused, or they can go in either category. But while I'm thinking about it, I don't want to miss it. One of the things when I interview every new family coming into the school, not all heads of schools do that. To me, it's still a real priority. So I have one interview a day for really most of the spring. And I promised every one of them, we will make mistakes with your children, and we will sin against your children, and I will sin against you. I'm absolutely sure. And what happens is, and I say, and you might too. You might in your home. So I want to create this atmosphere where parents, teachers, and administrators are free to admit we make mistakes. You got, in my school of almost 500, we've got a lot of people living in really close community together. We're all over each other, right? If there's the freedom to admit that, to be able to lead with our weaknesses and our need, then we have the ability to really make good progress. So I think it's a really important thing for the head of school to model. I also think GTD stands for getting things done. One of the things that I think a head of school has to learn is the ability to do project and task management. Well, it sounds like a real businessy, nitty-gritty thing, but managing your school and tasks and projects through email is deadly, and it won't work in the long term. So we use a system called Nosby. I know some people use Wrike, other kinds of tools. There are probably a number of them out there, OmniFocus. There's one I looked at, Priority Matrix. But You've got to develop a way with your key leadership team to manage projects and tasks in an efficient manner, because it's a lot of stuff we're doing. It's a tremendous amount of activity. So the third point is key people. Only the head of school can hire, manage, lead, and develop the key people and the talent needed to execute. And the most important, the fourth, is culture. As I said, the head of school is the chief cultural architect. I think I'm responsible to define the culture. Some of that's done when you write the portrait of the graduate. Some of it's done when you write the mission statement. But a lot of it's done when you're writing your handbook and you're talking about, I think it's really big to talk about what you're for and not what you're against. I came to ACCS years ago, and I think I heard Matt Riddling talk about standards, and we just love that idea of a standard. We don't use the word rule very much. Talk about standards and loving the standard, what we're for, and not what we're against. And so I think the head of school has to define that and be in front of the faculty, parents, and staff communicating the marks and the attributes that make up our culture. Which largely goes to Jamie Smith's idea, his new book out, You Are What You Love, which is a more accessible version of Desiring the Kingdom. He's a philosopher, so it still might not be accessible enough for some of you. But it's really good. But it gets to that point. What if education were not so much about what we know versus what we love? We have to get good at talking about what we love in classical Christian schools. And I think this is one of the differences that if, you know, when Bill was talking earlier about the general Christian school culture, I think this is where we tend to do better. We raise up the things and hold up high the things that are true and beautiful and good. And I believe over time, the words we say and the liturgies we practice do direct our students' affections toward those things. And that's what I'm seeing in our outcomes. So I'm not discouraged about what I'm seeing in graduates when we create schools where the culture is marked by grace, where it's marked by repentance. It's not legalism, it's not behaviorism, it's not moralism. It's sinners living in community together, exploring what does it mean to be brothers and sisters in Christ. And I think this conversation has to dominate the life of our schools. Certainly, Bill with ISM is right that the faculty is the key part here. As your faculty culture goes, so goes your school. Second to that, I would say middle school boys. Your school culture rises and falls on middle school boys, meaning that's when we have to win their hearts. My high school boys aren't giving me the problem on the larger, or at least it's like when I'm speaking to my whole high school, I can isolate it to the two or three that I know are resisting where we're going when we're talking about the things we love and the standard. But every middle school boy doesn't know if it's cool or not. And we have to, in building culture, we have to be super intentional with middle school boys. In the midst of all the business that I have as a head of school, this was the first year that I didn't coach middle school boys basketball, and I really regret it because it gives me a window in their life at a time where then I have their attention and I know them, can make eye contact. So I've got to figure that out next, but I know that I've got to find a way to stay engaged with middle school boys. So culture making is it's this work of cultivating. It's about, you know, what we love, helping them love the things that are loving, worth loving, hating the things that are worth hating, and persuading them, inviting them into that conversation, and persuading them, not just telling them. There are a few things we do. This is the ISM segment of introducing a couple of tools. I do implement the annual ISM surveys. So I do two faculty culture surveys a year. They're straight out of ISM. And I use the student experience profile every October or November. You'll read these questions, and they are not particularly Christian, but they are generally human. There's not one in there that's not healthy and Christian in the broadest sense of what we understand human beings, humans need. And so, but they're worded in some interesting ways. Number one on the student experience profile out of, I think, 12 or 16 questions says, And I've got fifth graders through 11th graders taking the survey once a year. I do it in a blink format. I go in at every class at the same time, hand it out for 5 minutes, and they answer on a scale of 1 to 9 these 12 items. Number one says, I have very much looked forward to coming to school every day of this entire grading period. There are research firm. Every statement it sounds like that. But it gets at issues of being respected by their peers, respected by their teachers, believing that the playing field is level, a number of other things. So I've administered that survey and the faculty now for 5 or 6 years. So I have good data that I can watch just the slightest tweaks or movements in that, which are very helpful. The other thing we added a couple years ago, and I would invite you to, is we got a bunch of classical Christian schools to administer the same test at the same time, late October, early November, and they all sent the results into me because I offered to compile them. But I was able then to show, because if you do the survey, you can compare yourself to independent schools' numbers, and we beat them soundly, and we should, right? But the question is, how are we doing against other schools that have the same affections and the same philosophy and operating off of the same ideals? So I think that could be a really cool project for ACCS, for those, for as many who want to participate in it. I'd love to give the management over to somebody else, David, if he's in the room somewhere. But the idea that we could have some data and see how we're doing against other schools that are like us. There's another conversation that's happening toward the idea of adding 3 to 4 questions at the end of it that are particularly classical and Christian. So we leave the 12 as is, but then we add a few at the end that we all agree upon that's worked out over time. You know, these 3 or 4 questions best capture what we would like to know from students' perspective about their classical Christian education. So that's just an idea. But I do that every year. I do the 2 faculty culture profiles, which are similar. We do a front page and a back page. On the front page, we do the ISM tool. And on the back page, we implemented a new tool that asks the faculty questions in 3 categories with about 3 or 4 subpoints that get at things that are particularly classical and Christian about our culture. So we administer that, we enter the data, and we just watch it, you know, year by year, if that makes sense. And then there's another tool called the 16 Head of School Characteristics that we did every year for a while, and now we do it every 2 to 3 years. But in ISM's research, they identified these 16 characteristics in schools that met a number of criteria. The head seemed to be in place for a long time, highly respected, the school was accomplishing its mission, blah, 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 long list of things. Not any one head is all 16. You won't score high in all 16 areas. But the idea is these are the 16 prominent traits. It's kind of like a good to great exercise. And we've done that consistently as well. Basically, I send that out, and all the faculty comment on my leadership in about 16 areas. It's very difficult. So it's good medicine. But it's been helpful to us. And we've used that. We've used some of my lower scores on that tool in my professional development plan and in my annual head of school agenda. We have a professional development part of that, and we've used that in there. All right, for the sake of time, I could spend a lot of time on this cultural piece because I think it's the most important job for the head of school. And it does extend beyond the student culture and the faculty culture. It extends in the parent culture. It gets into this. We as heads of school have to be good at conflict resolution, normalizing conflict, in other words, dealing with things quickly. So that root, root of bitterness or these issues don't build and grow. A lot of heads of schools are really resistant to that, and we've just got to get over it. It's one of the most important things we can do. So I mentioned the surveys and normalizing conflict. There we go. So those are the 4 things that I think only the head can do. Be the primary vision caster. Help come up with a strategic plan. Your board should be leading that, but then once it's developed, you've got to take that and run with it. Developing your key people, and then you're the only one, and then building your culture, and then you're the only one that can relate to your board technically. So this is the 5th one that's automatic because no one else is allowed to do this. And so Ideally, most of us are in the struggle or have gone through the struggle where you're moving, your board is moving from the working board that really ran the school to the governing board. Once the board is a governing board, it's only got four really main responsibilities. Once it's in that position, interpreting and guarding the mission, securing the financial future, the long-term viability of the school, hiring, managing, and evaluating the head, and then perpetuating itself. It's really funny when 25% of your job description as a board is just to replace yourself. But that's the only deadly mistake a board can make that you can't, that could kill the school. The board can make mistakes in, they can hire the wrong head, they can have bad documents, they can make a lot of mistakes that are redeemable, but the slippery slope is every board member replacement has to be very, very thoughtful, because that's where it all, there are a lot of us think if we just get all the documents right, we'll be great. There are a lot of great documents at really bad schools that used to be Christ-centered and evangelical. The documents haven't changed. Nobody reads them. So don't think you'll clear it up just by having the best constitutional documents and statement of faith. It's who are the board members that are being replaced. So there's no more important job. But when a board's doing that, then the head of school and his team can be freed to go run the school operationally. So the board can stay strategic, think about long term, the idea that the board has no living constituents. The board exists to secure the school's future for the children of the current children. That kind of idea. And so a lot of boards don't even know that. So leading up, as a head of school, you have to, as Bill talked about earlier, creatively and respectfully get things in front of them. Help them come to a conference. Help them come to a seminar or read some ISM materials or other board governance documents and materials that are out there. But managing and leading up and helping your board, for many of you, I one of the things I found in the early days of classical Christian education, our boards, a lot of the boards were geeking out on classical Christian education just like we were. Well, I was one of the board members. I mean, I was reading all the books. I was going to all the conferences. What's happened now is we do have a lot of schools that have become successful. And they're attractive to families, and they're coming in, and then there are potential board members that are good fits as far as, you know, they seem to have a commitment to classical Christian education. I think on the whole, we have a lot of board members with a lower understanding of that. And so board training and board orientation, getting boards to understand not only their role in governing, but really understanding classical Christian education. So our board members sign four documents every year, which really are great for me because they help protect me. And if the board didn't have a person in July making sure we were signing these things, that'd be one of the areas I would be leading up. I'd have them there. Remember, and they sign the statement of faith, a conflict of interest form, a one-pager board do's and don'ts, kind of remembering what you do and don't as a board member. And then this, we have a page that's front and back that's the kind of our core tenets of what we mean when we say classical Christian education. And they sign all those documents. But I'm also in front of them giving them articles to read, recommending conferences, inviting them to conferences. I got one board member to a conference last week because I made her, I put her as a speaker on the agenda. Well, she came and spoke and gave a great seminar and spent 3 days soaking up great classical Christian content. And she's my chairman of the board, which is very satisfying and encouraging to me. So, for the sake of time, I'm going to cut it off. The last thing I will mention, if there was a sixth that I would add, as a head of school, you've got to know the numbers. You've got to, if this is not your background, get good at the financials, get good at the P&L, get good at balance sheets, get good at budgeting, and get good at a 5 to 7 year forecast. I have a good idea what my tuition is going to be in 6 years from now, and I won't be off because I have a forecast where at a detailed level, I've projected growth, I've projected the expenses that come along with growth, and for my banks, for my donors, for my board. That is just, I can't over the last 4 or 5 years, I've just become so convinced at how important that is. I think the head of school needs to know the numbers better than any board member, better than your banker, and better than your bookkeeper. Because they don't think, none of those groups think about it in the holistic way. So there were three or four tools I was going to mention that I would recommend to you real quickly in my toolbox. I use Nosby for project and task management. I use Helm for budgeting and forecast planning and communication. It's a budgeting, forecasting, and communication tool, dashboard. They're here at the conference downstairs. And full disclosure, I developed a really sophisticated way to do this off of Excel for years, and a couple of computer science kids at the University of Virginia just took it and made it a program, and they won the University of Virginia Incubator Entrepreneur Award. So it's my little company downstairs. But anyway, I use Helm. I use the Colby to assess as I'm bringing people on the team. Sometimes we use Myers-Briggs as well, but the Colby I'm a big fan of, don't have time to explain. I'm a big fan of Patrick Lencioni and his book, The Advantage, and really all of his books, but that's something we learn, that's lingo from in terms of how we organize our team from a position in terms of our help, but also what we do in meetings and in many ways. So I'm a big fan of Lencioni and Evernote as well. So anyway, I wanted to throw those tools out real quick, and we have 5 minutes before the end of the session. Sorry I flew through all that too so quickly. But anyway, questions? Yes, sir. It's almost like I planted him. That's a great question. Who are the best members for the Head Support and Evaluation Committee? So ISM used to recommend 6. They don't anymore, and I agree with them. I think it should be 3 because it's got to be small enough that you can call a meeting quickly, and if you get to a 4th or 5th member, it's hard to get them there. So so I like it to be 2 board members, and they have to have the ability. They can't be anyone that has a natural suspicion or question of the head, but they can't just be yes men either. So I have 2 good friends on the board that are on my committee, but they have the ability and have to have the ability to be dispassionate in matters of my accountability and support. So 2 board members. And then one of the things that we do is we get an outside person. So I just asked a head of a school in Texas who's at a school further along than mine to be on my head support and evaluation committee this year. And he said, yes, I'm really thankful. He'll call in once a quarter, and that 2 of them will be in the room and 1 will be on the phone. Other heads of schools that are a little bit further along than you are a good 3rd person. I serve on a couple of them as well. I think it'd be awesome if a lot of us served on one another's head support and evaluation committee on the committees. It's a really good way to do it. Yes. No, I can't choose them. No, the board has to choose it. So the Committee on Trustees is the other board that I didn't talk about, or the Committee on Directors. But that's the group that decides and puts a slate of committees out every year that the whole board would approve. Now, they want my input, and so they asked me recently, hey, this person's rolling off. We're thinking about these 2 people for the committee. What do you think? And it's a conversation, as is the agenda that we come up with for the year. But it's got to feel like teamwork. The other thing is the Head Support and Evaluation Committee members need to be people who have extensive organizational understanding and leadership experience. And ideally, they're people that you would go to for advice even if they weren't on that committee in your role as a head of school. You know, great question. A couple more minutes. Well, that's disappointing. No. Anything else? Statement of faith, conflict of interest form, what I call a board do's and don'ts. Basically, it's a reminder of, I understand as a board member this is how I behave, and these are the things I do, and I understand these are the things I don't do. And then lastly would be a front and back page, that it's our ability to capture the core tenets of what we mean when we say classical Christian education, so that a board member isn't saying, well, you know, I don't know about Latin, you know, or any myriad of things that they might ask about. Yes, you can. Absolutely. I share them all the time. Here's my problem in meetings like this. I say yes, and if I don't have a mechanism to get them to you, then I'm really bad at it. So I guess, I don't know. Oh, wonderful. Email me and I've got a brilliant new assistant that gets that knows where all this stuff is and gets it to you. Great. Anything else? Yes. Don't have that kind of a situation. You got to have one boss, one head. You can't have divided leadership. No. That'd be my advice. Yeah. I can't imagine that working. So. Thank you very much. Have a great day.